Sides of world conflicts have always been financed by the same people. And as I've said before, there seems to be a method to the madness going on in the world. There's no hope. We cannot depend on our leaders. Our leaders are misleaders. There is a science that they're following. They have their own agenda, and it doesn't include you.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are again on a very special edition of the Michael Deacon program. We have Dr. Michael Shermer, who is joining us right now at this very moment. Let's patch him in. Michael, are you alive?
I'm here. Yeah. I'm just waiting for you to come on.
Nice. I'm glad you are here. Really do appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. So how are you? It's been some time since we last talked.
Oh, things are good. I'm still skeptical of a lot of things and not others. I just attended a big lecture by the Shakespeare skeptics. Do you know about these people?
I actually don't. Please do tell.
It's a it's the authorship question. Shakespeare authorship question. SAQ is their handle, and their thing is that there's very little paper trail to prove that someone named William Shakespeare wrote those plays. So from there, you go down the rabbit hole of who you think actually wrote them, and there's, you know, like 50 different possible candidates. The leading one is this guy named Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford. So they're called the Oxfordians, in contrast with the Stratfordians, since Shakespeare was from Stratford on Avon. And it's the kind of debate when you tell people about it, they go, huh?
Oh, of course.
But, you know, to these people, boy, it's fighting words. Boy, they can't wait to get into it, and they can regale you for hours with why they're skeptical.
Definitely hold that thought, since we are going to go back to exactly what you're talking about here later on in the conversation, the fact that some people get, I guess you could say, quote-unquote, triggered at certain things.
Triggered, yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's true.
Oh, yes.
You know, and the more committed you are behaviorally and cognitively, that is, how much of your life is invested in your particular belief, the harder it is to give it up. So, you know, things like, I've changed my mind on a number of things, but I wasn't really that invested in it. Like gun control, yes or no, this or that, you know, I don't care. I don't own a gun. Doesn't matter to me. Something like that. Climate change, you know, I'm not a climate scientist. If it turned out the whole thing was wrong, it wouldn't matter to me.
It wouldn't kill you.
It doesn't hurt me, yeah.
Right.
You know, I understand politicians, you know, they can't just switch parties, or people that are preachers that are committed to a particular religion and have a flock, you know, they can't, it's hard to give that up when they have doubts. So I'm sympathetic to them.
Yeah, some people certainly are married to their thoughts and opinions wholeheartedly. And Michael, the last time we talked, we went into your career, and this time I wanted to explore other topics of interest. And for those who don't know, Dr. Michael Shermer here has written many thought-provoking books, many I recommend to all of you out there. I've recommended your books quite a few times, actually.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Oh, yes. And I have to tell you right away here, Michael, as soon as I even announced that you would be on here, I was hit with several emails, even people on Twitter. Many seem to really have it out for you to some degree.
Imagine that, Twitter, being upset about something.
Right. A shocker, right?
It's a shocker, yes. Well, it depends on what, you know, which people, which group I've offended, you know, who knows. I have been pretty hard on the far left and progressives, the social justice warriors, as they're called, mainly because I think they've corrupted liberalism. You know, I'm a liberal in that sense, classical liberal, libertarian. Liberal values like free speech and separation of church and state and reproductive rights for women and, you know, these sorts of things. You know, follow the science where it leads, like on climate change, for example. I think global warming is real and human caused. Right down the line, most liberals that I know go, yep, Shermer, you're a liberal. You know, but if you push back just a little bit, like, you know, I think the far left has gone too far, you know, you're a right-wing Nazi. No, I'm not. or on Twitter, they complain I don't criticize the far right, or like Christian conservatives and groups like that, which I have done in the past, like in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. You know, I just hammered the creationists, for example, pretty much daily, and the religious right and all the shenanigans they were up to. You know, but the thing is, we expect that from them. You know, it's no surprise when, you know, a Christian group doubts evolution, or a far right, alt right group, starts talking about white supremacy. You know, I mean, I don't really need to point out how ridiculous that is, although I do occasionally. It's when people on the left who, you know, start talking about censoring speech because speech is hateful and hateful speech is a form of violence and violence cannot be tolerated. Therefore, we cannot tolerate somebody else's opinions. Then I go, wait a minute. Now, this is the side that's supposed to be in favor of tolerance and openness and free speech. And now they've become censorious. How did that happen?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. No, I was just going to say, it is funny how that seems to be problematic, especially with certain individuals who lean towards one side. If they see you to sort of share the same ideologies as they do and the same political, I guess you could say, influence or interest, anytime you even show a little bit of difference or individualism, that's when their opinion on you changes completely.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I've been thinking about this the last couple of weeks of this fusion fission process of groups forming and fusing to grow larger and more politically powerful. But then they destroy themselves from within. They fission into ever smaller groups as they fight and bicker over, you know, minutiae and tiny details. You know, Marxist groups did this, communist socialist groups did this, feminist groups did this, the atheists did this in the early 2000s. You know, who is the true atheist? Are you militant enough? Are you atheist plus? So you're in favor of social justice as well as atheism, and on. And pretty soon, you know, you've pretty much eaten yourself from inside. And this is what I'm afraid the Democrats are doing for the 2020 election. They're just, you know, destroying themselves from within. I saw this yesterday when that LGBTQ group defenestrated Martina Navratilova. You know, who was like one of the earliest champions of not just women's rights, but, you know, gay rights and
right.
LGBTQ rights. And, you know, why? Because she said that a man who identifies as a woman and then goes to compete, say in her sport, tennis, has an unfair advantage because they're bigger, muscles are stronger.
Bone density, yes.
Bone density, the whole thing. And she says, I would not want to face a man who just says, I identify as a woman and then beats the crap out of her, you know, either figuratively in tennis or in MMA fighting and boxing. I mean, somebody could be killed.
Yeah, for an example, there is Fallon Fox, who is an MMA fighter who was born a man and now went through the process of becoming a woman, I guess you could say, and competes with the woman.
Yep, there was a cyclist who won a age division championship a few months ago, and you see her, a man identifying as a woman, and you see her on the podium with the other two women. It's like, holy moly! I mean, she's like 6'2" and this massive, huge body and massive legs, and you know the two petite girls standing next to her. It's like, yeah, that was fair.
I don't exactly know how that is fair to be competing against someone that you are just physically stronger than.
It's not fair. And
naturally.
But the point is that you can't even say you don't think it's fair, even if you're Martina Navratilova. Oh my God. If she can't say that, you know, then this is what I mean. We're screwed. I mean, well, you know, there goes liberalism down the drain. I mean, this open commentary and debate and disputation over ideas. You have to be able to talk about these things and to push back and say, you know, no, I just don't think a man identifying as a woman competing in a women's division in the sport is fair. Why not? Okay, well, let's have the debate and talk about bone density and muscle mass and so on. No, it's not a debate. You can't even talk about it.
It's sad, really. And that's the climate that we exist in today. And
it's not like me, mm-hmm. You know, a middle-aged white guy can't say it. Martina Navratilova can't say it.
I'm offended. I'm offended already.
Right.
Yes. And it is. It's really crazy. Go ahead.
Worried about this. You know, the climate on college campuses is getting ever more precarious with, you know, safe spaces and trigger warnings and the deplatforming of speakers that students don't like. You know, every time Ben Shapiro and, Dinesh D'Souza go to speak, you know, they get booed and marched against and they try to silence them by pounding on the windows and making, you know, noisemakers and, or standing up in the middle of the auditorium and chanting so that the people can't hear what the speaker has to say. You know, it's not just the right of the speaker to speak. It's the right of the audience to hear. They came there to hear this person speak. Now, I know both Dinesh and Ben, and we disagree on a lot of really deep, important issues, but I respect their opinions. They're smart, well thought out, well argued. Right. I assign my students, if you want to do your project on the abortion issue, you know, you got to watch Ben Shapiro and line up his 9 arguments why the pro-choice position is immoral and the pro-life position is moral. Now, I'm pro-life, barely, but I'm pro-life. I think I can counter his arguments, but if you can't, then how strong is your position really? And you know, as John Stuart Mill said, he who knows only his own position doesn't even know that. And, you know, so you got to know what the other side says. And it's not like, you know, a professional agitator like Milo Yiannopoulos. I can kind of see why campuses may not want to invite him. They don't have to invite
him. What happened to him, by the way? He seemed to have disappeared all of a sudden.
Yeah, he's kind of doing his own thing. He has his own company now. He published his own book. He has his own whatever product line and merchandise. And I see him pop up periodically, although, you know, he's been shut out of most social media, so he doesn't come onto my radar very often. So I don't know. Every time he tries to make an appearance, he gets shut down. Now let's make a distinction here. It's not that I think every university should invite Milo Yiannopoulos to speak.
Right.
I wouldn't invite him to like a skeptics event to give him a platform equal to that of some, you know, say Alan Dershowitz from Harvard or something like that. But that doesn't mean, if somebody invites him that he should be disinvited. If you invite somebody, stand by your word, honor your contract and your obligations and don't be shut down. Don't wimp out and cave in and
That's
apologize
true.
To the students.
Very true. Very true. But this is his, I guess you could say his gimmick.
Well, yes. And this is the worst thing. I mean, he wants them to do what exactly they do.
Well, of course he is trolling and baiting
them. He's trolling.
Them.
The last thing Milo Yiannopoulos wants is an empty room where nobody comes. He wants riots and protesters and people screaming. He eats it up. So, you know, that's doubly stupid to do that.
Probably not the wisest way to carry about, because eventually someone will get upset with you and pull the carpet underneath your feet there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You don't want that. And Michael, as you know, or well, you may or may not know this, but I see all of this from the psychological angle, where I am wildly fascinated by human behavior and what other individuals choose to be passionate about and what they choose to let them get so upset over. Triggered, in other words.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a whole interesting psychology going on here, unraveling. In fact, today with the Jussie Smollett story.
Jussie Smollett,
yeah. Yeah, where, you know, why would somebody fake or hoax?
Ooh, yes.
Attack? Well, it's because our culture values victimhood and elevates it to a high status where you get a lot of attention and love and affection and support, particularly media attention, which apparently he wanted, you know, just from being a victim. And, you know, he's not the first. I mean, there's a litany of these, hoaxed claims going back. Well, just in the last year and a half since Trump was elected, but even further back, I mean, there was that case that Oprah had on, James Frey, who wrote that book, A Million Little Pieces, allegedly a memoir about his, well, essentially kind of a victimhood status of being a drug addict. Turns out he made it all up. Nothing happened. Nothing like that happened to him. And she reamed him. She invited him back on the couch, the Oprah couch. And he's thinking, oh boy, I'm going to get a lot of love, even though he'd already been exposed. And she just reamed him. And, some of my friends think Jesse's going to go on Ellen's couch and weep and cry and say, yeah, I hoaxed it, but You know, I couldn't help myself because it's so hard being black and gay in the age of Trump and, you know, hope for sympathy there. I don't think that's going to happen. This case is too big and the Chicago Police Department is pretty pissed off about this. You know, this is, you know, Chicago is now one of the most dangerous cities, the highest homicide rates, you know, in the United States and quite a distinct reversal from the overall trend of the decline of violence and homicide. The police need every detective working on real cases, and they just wasted, you know, 2 weeks, 25 detectives working on the Jesse Smollett case, and, you know, just a complete waste of time.
It really,
that's no good.
It really was, and I did want to get your opinion on that and the whole media fiasco over Jesse Smollett, or as some will pronounce his last name, Jesse Smollett. Apparently conducting this false flag operation, hiring two fellow actors, people that he knows, to choreograph basically an attack. That was some pro wrestling type behavior there, Michael.
Yes,
it really
right.
was.
Yeah, so it's there's additional lessons here. When you hire somebody to hoax something like this, don't write a check out of your checkbook.
Seriously, the media, of course, really ate it up, playing the victim card and getting sympathy, and that's what the media was really trying to get over on the general public.
It's harder and harder to pull things off like this because of all the cameras around everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, everything is digitized. You can track, you know, credit card purchases and bank transfers and things like this. You know, it's hard to pull off something like that now. And also, how much do you need to pay somebody for them to keep their mouth shut when they're called in and shown the badge and a gun and said, if you lie, you're going to jail for perjury now?
Or deported.
Do you know about this crime? You know, and of course, the average person is going to, oh, I did it. He told me to do it. He paid me. And so, you know, you have to pay somebody a lot of money to be willing to go to jail for you. And he apparently was willing to send these guys down the road just for that attention.
And they were Nigerian men. I think the possibility of being deported was also on the table.
Totally. And then I heard a story just like an hour ago that he already has a police record where he got a DUI a few years ago, and he gave them initially his brother's name and ID.
Incredible.
I mean, so he's willing to send his brother down the river.
Incredible, that's, really. But what do you expect from actors, you know, being phony? That's not a surprise.
Well, yeah, he's an actor. So, yes, he can put up a good act.
He really ruined his career there, Michael, in my opinion. Even at this point, Louis C.K. has a better chance of getting a Netflix special than Jesse Smollett has to headlighting a sitcom.
Yeah, I would be surprised if Empire keeps him on their employment records.
I think they might even get rid of him, yeah.
He's probably finished. You know, this story was bigger than almost any of the other hoax stories from the last 2 years. It goes back to maybe what was her name? Tawana. This was back in the 90s. The black woman who said she was raped and so forth, to Tawana Brawley. You know, that was, the whole thing was fake. Just like the Duke LaCrosse story was fake, you know, and the whole Rolling Stone coverage, you know, this is the problem, you know, it's like, it's the confirmation bias, it's motivated reasoning. You know, once you have a worldview, we live in a racist America, everybody's a bigot and so on, and you start looking for it everywhere. It's getting harder to find because, in fact, we're becoming ever less racist and bigoted than compared over the centuries. Things are getting much better, so it's harder to find. So when somebody fakes it and it fits the narrative, you know, you're more likely to accept it uncritically until it starts unraveling. Now, of course, all those commentators, they've gone silent.
It's funny how that happens.
Or they say something like, let's not pass judgment until all the facts are in. Yeah, well, you should have said that in the first place.
Right. And I also got to say, those MAGA hats, whoever came up with that idea and put it on the hat, I have to say, they must be raking in lots and lots of money on those hats.
Well, now, especially, yeah. Yeah, I see Trump tweeted out at him because initially he gave support. He said, this is a terrible thing that happened to him. And then of course he naturally is, you know, firing back as he's wont to do. I do wish Trump would stay off of social media, but.
Well, I think that's what also helped him get over that sort of.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm,
that sort of style that he has there. It's a very pro wrestling-esque.
Totally.
But he's friends with Vince McMahon. So, I mean, you got to expect that. And he's been there a couple times.
I feel like we're living in a reality TV series
oh,
now.
Oh, I said that back in 2016. I said the show was about to begin, and my God, was I ever right?
Yeah.
It's scary. But those hats, Michael, they have totally taken a life of its own. They symbolize a magnitude of concepts for the human psyche. Incredible.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a little bit like, I mean, every president has their slogan. So, you know, the famous Obama poster.
Yeah.
The chain.
Powerful.
That was pretty powerful, too.
Right.
You know, all the way back to, you know, I like Ike buttons and so on. I mean, that's all the way with LBJ and so on. That's pretty normal. The hat, I guess, gets a little more coverage because it's visible. It's red. It's the white letters. It's on somebody's head. You know, it's easier to read than a button that goes on your lapel, say, or a poster that's hanging up far away. So, yeah.
Oh, yes. And, of course, we saw the media frenzy over the Covington teenager wearing the hat as well.
Yeah, he's suing the Washington Post now.
$250
million.
Good,
you know,
Lord.
That's pocket change for Jeff Bezos. But
it is, but that's a big payday.
I'm sympathetic to him now, what happened and how bad he was treated. But I don't know about lawsuits. I mean, that, again, you know, when you bring the government in, the law, and that's pretty heavy-duty stuff, you know, he's going to have to prove damages. I mean, it's one thing to say you lied about me, yes, but to actually collect money, you have to prove that you were harmed. Now, how's he going to do that as a high schooler? I mean, you know, like I lost my $100,000 a year job. No, you know, so he's going to have a hard time with that. But you know, if nothing else, maybe it sends a message to the media to
right.
you know not jump on those stories too quickly. I mean, if there's a 30-second video clip, you might at least ask, is there more video?
Yep.
Before you write the story. Or you might say, based on this 30-second clip, it looks like X, but we're withholding judgment until we see the whole video. Something like that.
Correct. That would have been the strong and rational thing to do for this whole incident, really. And once I realized the other group that Indian man came from, the Black Hebrew Israelite group.
Right.
I love those guys, to be honest with you. I am completely entertained and amused. I'm not making fun of them, but just how they go about and scream their opinions at the top of their lungs out in different street corners in the New York area. Well, different places around America, but the most videos that you see online, if you look them up on YouTube, it's all New York stuff, really, and really, really entertaining.
I didn't really follow them. I never heard of them before all this happened, and they seem a pretty problematic group. Not big time. Not anything I would endorse.
It's a very militant group.
Yeah. Definitely pretty problematic. But, you know, whatever. I mean, that's the problem is that, you know, we didn't see any of that until later.
Yeah, much later.
Part of the problem with social media is that, you know, if you feel like I need to be on social media most of the day and commenting, and if a couple of days go by without you commenting at all, you start to feel like, well, I got to get it back in there because everybody's talking about X. So the pressure is to say something. I mean, I feel this because I'm on social media a fair amount, but every once in a while I'll just go off for a couple of days. I won't look. I won't write anything. And it's actually kind of liberating. Like, you know what? I missed that. And that's what happened with the Covington thing. I was in one of my periodic social media fasts and I missed the first initial wave. So when it started to break, I thought, oh, thank God, because I might have gotten pissed when I saw that picture of the smirking kid. So it's not like I was like, you know, had superpowers to overcome the temptation to moralize. Everybody wants to moralize, but that's human nature. But so thank God I was off social media. I think it's good, you know, Jaron Lanier, you know, he has that book, you know, Why We Should Get Off Social Media Permanently. I wouldn't go that far. I think social media is a useful tool, but, you know, it's good to take some time off just to get some perspective on issues.
I agree completely with that. Sometimes it's best not to get so personally involved. I mean, it's good to read the news and be up to date, but once you let it start affecting your outside life and, you know, kind of becoming, you start to, because some people I know that are completely engulfed in the political spectrum, they can't even enjoy a movie or anything on TV before they start to politicize everything.
Yeah, I'm fortunate. I'm a little older. I'm 64. So to get into social media and all that, I kind of had to force myself. I wasn't eager to do it. I felt like I needed to do it to stay relevant.
Well, you're a prominent figure, Michael.
well, I'm on Kathy Griffin's D list, I think, as prominent figures go.
Well,
but I kind of felt like I got to do it, but it's not like, it's not in my blood. I don't feel like I got to do this every day or else I'm going to get anxious, you know?
Sure.
I have no problems taking half a day off or a day off or a couple of days off social media. And it actually feels good doing that. And, you know, that's not bad advice for everybody, I think.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's a big debate now, with the Jonathan Haidt and Gene Twenge on one side saying too much social media leads to this, you know, coddling of the American mind or the iGeners, as Gene calls them, kids having more, social, mental issues, anxiety, depression, suicide, ideation, and so on, which they attribute to too much screen time, too much social media. Well, there's a new study. This is how science works. A new study published, two studies published last week, finding no relationship between screen time and mental issues at all. Zero. So, you know, that's sort of how it goes in science. You wish one experiment would, or one study would settle it, but it rarely is the case that you get settled science. Even these recommendations, like keep your kid off the screen no more than 2 hours a day. You know, no, that's probably not the problem. It's not just screen time. There's other issues. They could probably be on 6 hours a day as long as they're doing other things as well. You know, it has to be balanced.
You're right on that. And there's different articles online that all allegedly say things like how social media increases depression and loneliness for teenagers or adults.
Well, right. The cohort that they're talking about are like 13 to 19 year olds. That is, they're in high
school
and just entering college that they seem to be having these problems. There is a spike. Okay. The data is there that there's a spike starting around 2013, which is when iGeners started college. These are kids born in 1995 or after. A spike in self-reported anxiety and depression and suicide ideation. Now, when I say spike, I mean from like 3% to 6% for boys. So again, it's not like it's half of all boys are, you know, thinking about killing themselves. No. And for girls, it was, I think 4% to 15%. So it was more than a tripling. It might have been 5% to 15%, but basically a threefold increase. But again, the numbers are still pretty small. I mean, I teach a class of, you know, 25 students in a seminar. You know, most of them are perfectly normal, perfectly happy. They're not raging, screaming, moralizing, or depressed, suicide type kids. You know, they're just normal kids. So when we talk about an increase, we mean it was a pretty small number to begin with, which kind of reminds me of another statistical mistake people make in reading studies and the way the media reports it. They'll say something like, well, there was a 100% increase in the rates of prostate cancer, for example, or just some weird disease or something like that. You go, oh my God, that's incredible. I better get checked up. Well, you look at the study and it's like, you know, 2 out of 100,000 people get this particular cancer. And now it's 4 out of 100,000. You go, 4 out of 100,000. So the chances of me getting this are pretty much nil. I'm not going to rush to the doctor.
Yeah.
So you got to look at the original study to see what they mean when they just use a percentage, you know, this huge increase, but the original number was tiny.
Yeah, I agree. I still agree with certain studies. I definitely think it could become problematic for some young minds out there who are easily influenced. For instance, we could look at the mainstream media and those who watch and consume it daily. That's where the cognitive biasness comes in, or the cognitive dissonance comes into play for many of these individuals that we talk to on a daily basis, Michael, say at a Starbucks.
Yeah. Yeah. So we all travel in our own little bubbles. That's okay. That's perfectly normal. We're tribal that way. Part of our nature. It's okay. You know, I like hanging with my cycling buddies or my science friends or my skeptic atheist friends or whatever and go out for drinks and talk and complain about, you know, those other people over there that are idiots because they don't believe what we believe. You know, everybody does that.
We all do that. Yeah.
Yeah, we all do that. So the part of the problem that, you know, it's been apparent since the 2016 election is, you know, the manipulation of social media by outside agents. And now there's some research on showing how this works. You know, you can, you know, Google Trump or Google Hillary and, you know, and you get a Google page of 10 hits, 10 pages. And so in these faux experiments, where they'll have like 5 and 5, positive, negative, or 6 and 4, or 7 and 3, say, negative, positive ratio or whatever, people can't tell. I mean, the subject is kind of scanning and reading and looking, has no idea what the ratio is. But it does tilt their then later self-reported support for or criticisms of that candidate. And it directly correlates the number, that percentage, that ratio of positive to negative pages on that one Google hit page. So, you know, this is disturbing. Sometimes I champion, you know, free will and autonomy and rationality and reason and science and all that. But sometimes I feel like we're just rats in a Skinner box pressing bars, and we have no idea that there's somebody out there, you know, manipulating the reinforcement ratio of, you know, the number of reinforcements you get for hitting the left bar instead of the right bar. I mean, that's kind of what it feels like.
That's very true.
But maybe perhaps awareness of that. Like, you know, I'm just going to be cautious and know that, you know, somebody out there is trying to manipulate this stuff. You said
the key word, awareness. That's what we see here in America, the lack of self-awareness and just awareness in general.
Yeah, so this professor that did this research, I think it was at Stanford, I forget his name now, was talking about, like, say, for example, you want to tilt the election in favor of Trump. Now, you can't go to African-American communities online and try to make Trump appealing to them. They're probably not going to vote for Trump no matter what. But you can convince them that a vote for Hillary is not going to help you. She's not going to help the African-American community, so don't even bother to vote. That's a vote for Trump. You know, I hadn't really thought of it like that, but that's right. You can just tilt it just ever so slightly in that one direction, even though somebody may say, I have no interest in voting for Trump. By not voting for Hillary, you did vote for Trump.
Correct. And we've seen this go on for many, many years, different governments trying to influence different elections. We've done that too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you know, when you look at some of our foreign policies through the 70s and 80s and how we tried to manipulate elections in South American countries. You know, we like this dictator more than that dictator, because the one dictator we can control, we can't control the other dictator.
That's how it's gone on forever, and selling arms and selling drugs. That's kind of how everything started and still continues.
Yeah, so Christopher Hitchens wrote that book about Henry Kissinger as a war criminal. It's like, what are you talking about? I always thought Kissinger was great, but no. You know, he was involved in all these shenanigans in South American countries that, you know, that it's a kind of a conspiracy in a way that the Pentagon Papers revealed.
That's like a real conspiracy, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and now the WikiLeaks in a way. I mean, you know, we didn't. No one was talking about the NSA and what they were doing and you know, tapping Americans' phones and not just metadata, but actual conversations and emails and so on. And it's like, what? I thought we lived in a liberal democracy where, you know, we have certain constitutionally protected rights. Maybe not.
Maybe not. That's very true. You could just look back at the whole FBI COINTELPRO, and that gets into some very dirty stuff as well. And going back to social media and different platforms of that nature, I'm surprised in today's climate that you still have any platform, myself included. I know that Facebook and YouTube aren't very kind about my program, and the days of freedom of speech and freedom of thought are sort of disappearing every day,
yeah,
Michael.
There's a lot of us pushing back. I think this too shall pass. I think this is, you know, the kind of pendulum swinging back and forth. It's sort of understandable why the far left went too far to the left, just like the far right went too far to the right in the 80s and 90s and then got pushed back in the 2000s. Okay, fine. That's how it's supposed to work, as long as those opportunities are still in place for us to push back. And that's why the protection of free speech is the most fundamental of all rights. Free speech is the most important right we have, because we only have our thoughts. That, you know, we just, you know, everything is filtered through our brains, and you have thoughts, but you have to communicate the thoughts, that speech, however loosely you want to define it. And if you can't speak your thoughts, then how do we know what other people are thinking? So everything else follows from that. So we got to protect that.
Definitely. The future of where this current game of PC culture takes us has me no doubt perturbed, Doctor.
Yeah, well, so just... So vigilance, that's it. We got to stay vigilant.
Definitely. I agree wholeheartedly on that. And By the way, Michael, we didn't talk about this last time, but you also have a podcast of your own.
Yeah, the Science Salon podcast. Love it. If you go to skeptic.com, you can see the Science Salon podcast, or just Google Science Salon. Yeah, I'm up to 54 different people I've talked to. I'm kind of specializing in science authors now. This is an extension of our Caltech Science Lecture Series we started in 1992, and then I migrated that to from lectures to conversations that I was holding in a small venue where it would be just like 50, 60 people present. But even that was cumbersome to do, you know, fly somebody in from the East Coast or wherever they are and then put them up in a hotel and order the books and get the ticket sales and all that stuff. That, with a podcast, with a, you know, Skype, I can in a studio and I can do it from anywhere. My guests can be anywhere at any time. And, it's a great, technology we have. And I mainly did this because I like consuming podcasts. I enjoy, you know, Joe Rogan, Dave Rubin, your podcast, Sam Harris's podcast, you know, Science, the whole Science Friday NPR podcast they have. And, you know, it's a great way to consume content. Well, I live in Southern California, so we do a lot of driving.
Absolutely, yes.
And when you're doing chores or, you know, I'm out cycling or hiking with my dog, you know, I'm listening to something, books on tape, a teaching company course, a podcast. And then last year I started, maybe 2 years ago now, started doing podcasts as a guest instead of mainstream media, you know, and it's so much better. Like here we're going on almost an hour now. And if I was on CNN, you know, I'd get my 6 minutes, or Bill Maher or any, you know, Larry King, you'd get an hour, but it's not even an hour because there's, you know, 22 minutes of commercials and he has four other guests all screaming at you. You know, it's hard to have a conversation. And you know, I miss that.
Yes. It really is hard to get certain, I guess, intellectual conversations going with certain people, but we don't always seek for that sort of enjoyment in our lives. Sometimes we like the chaos as well. And I'm sure you do too, Michael, talking to just people that aren't exactly completely aware. Sometimes the people that are completely unaware and lack, I guess you could say, well, I'll just leave it at that. I'll be polite today. I guess you could say you do enjoy casual conversation with normal folks out there as well.
Oh, I do. Yes. I mean, I always learn something new when talking to people. So for example, this weekend, on Saturday, I'm flying to, North Carolina for a debate I'm doing on the problem of evil with a theologian at the Southern Evangelical Seminary.
Oh my goodness. Amazing.
Everyone in the room is going to be not just religious, not just a theist, but an evangelical Christian.
Oh my.
We're pretty enthusiastic about being the one true religion, right? So now their problem they have to deal with is, you know, they believe that God is, you know, all good, all powerful and all knowing, omniscient, omnipotent and omnibenevolent and perfect. And of course existing. So
are you going to, Michael, yeah. I hate to cut you off, but are you going to be wearing all white for the evening?
I'm going to be wearing all black.
No, you should wear all white just to mess with them.
Yeah, that would mess with them. That'd be a lot of fun.
You should do that.
You know, why am I doing this? Well, of course they hire me, pay me to do it. Okay, fine. But I actually enjoy the process of engaging with people. And this is not a debate. Actually, it's an in conversation. So I'm actually going to get to push this guy pretty hard on his twisted logic of how you get, you know, from how do you square that circle? You know, that, and I'm not talking about like homicides because they'll say, oh, well, God gave people free will and they make bad choices and they'll pay for that in hell, something like that. No, what about like childhood leukemia? Or, you know, children that are killed in a tsunami. I mean, God could do something about that. Why doesn't he? You know, and what's the moral lesson that this 3-year-old is supposed to learn from this, or his grieving parents whose lives are ruined forever because they've lost their beloved children?
Well, Michael, that's because God has a plan for them.
Well,
my son.
I know this is a bullshit thing, you know. Well, that is an argument. You know,
it really is. That's scary.
Or it is, but basically, God works in mysterious ways. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. If I lost my kid to one of these tragedies, and a Christian said, you know, well, it's okay because God works in mysterious ways, I'd say, fuck you.
That's a great response, in my opinion.
It's the only response. I mean, you know, come on, seriously. You know, are they actually going to argue that there was some higher moral lesson to be? Yeah. Oh, so this woman gets raped. Oh, so here's an actual story. You know, in his book, The Language of God,
which theologian are we speaking of again?
Okay. This is Francis Collins. He's the head of the National Institutes of Health. He's big. He was the Human Genome Project director.
Oh, I know him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's huge, and he's an evangelical Christian. Okay, so I forget which book. It might have been The Language of God or the one after that, where he talks about the problem of evil, and his daughter was raped as a college student or something. It's amazing he had the courage to bring this up. But
Yeah.
Apparently with her permission, but yikes. You know, he sort of made this argument that she became a stronger person for it.
Hmm.
Wait, are you seriously arguing that, you know, rape is, this is good. It builds character. You know, of course, wow. He's not going to argue that, but that's kind of what's implied. Like, oh, this is okay. No, it's not okay. It's never okay.
It's not acceptable. That's true.
So anyway, so I'm looking forward to that on Saturday.
Well, that's going to be quite an evening.
Yeah. So, and it's live streamed. If this airs before this Saturday, then they can watch just SES, Southern Evangelical Seminary.com or something like that.
Very, very good. Yeah, definitely check that out, ladies and gentlemen. Get that streaming going. I would definitely go to that if I was in the area.
$10.
$10, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen.
And I'm going to hammer these guys. I mean, this is a great... Because I was once an evangelical. That's the other advantage I have.
You were also religious at one point.
Yeah, that's right. I went to Pepperdine University. It's an evangelical Christian school.
And,
yeah.
what happened, Michael? When did you turn your back on God?
Well, graduate school. It was science that did it.
The bloody science, yes.
You know, was it that science thing? Yeah, pretty much.
Well, check this out. This is always cruel. This little tidbit here. When I was in high school, I had a biology teacher who was a Jehovah's Witness, and I don't know how that happened. I really don't.
Well, the JWs, they do evangelize. They come to my door periodically. They're not quite as interesting as the Mormon boys when they come around.
Oh, those Mormons, yeah.
But they do have a program like that where they walk around. Now, when I became a born-again Christian in 1971, I was a senior in high school. I remember my friend Frank was always telling me I should accept Jesus as my Savior and so on. So I did. And then with another friend of mine. So then I came back Monday morning the next day, whenever it was, on a Monday morning, and I said, Frank, you know, I did it. I accepted Jesus. Well, which church did you go to? I said, yeah, it was the Presbyterian church there in Glendale. Oh, no, that's the wrong one.
Amazing.
Like, what? Wait a minute. What do you mean it's the wrong one? Oh, no, it's the Jehovah Witnesses. And like, well, sorry. That's the one I went to. So then he tried to talk me into going to the one true religion, the Witnesses. It's like already I knew, okay, there's something off here, you know, come on.
Yes. And by the way, I'm sure during this whole debate, you will be asked how you can have morality without God. I'm pretty sure they're going to ask you that eventually.
Yeah, of course that's coming and that's all right. I wrote a whole book about that.
Oh, they're going to love to throw that one at you.
I wrote a couple books about that. I wrote, The Science of Good and Evil, in which I first articulated, sort of an evolutionary argument for the foundations of the moral sentiments, that is these moral emotions, a sense of right and wrong and guilt and shame and so forth. And then in the moral arc, I show how the application of science and reason bends the moral arc toward more justice, and that it's not religion, but science and reason, since the enlightenment that has driven the moral progress. So I'll have plenty of ammo for them.
Oh, my. Yeah, speaking of individuals who lack self-awareness, you said reason. Yeah, that's something that they have no grasp of, Michael.
Well, they think they do. They have logical arguments. I mean, theologians have these convoluted, twisted.
It's twisted.
Argument. When I say twisted, I mean like a pretzel. I mean, I'm not a philosopher, so, you know, my eyes start to glaze over when they get down to, you know, point 14A. You know, let's go back to the premise that you started with, because that's where you went wrong. You know, and the premise is there is a God. There has to be a God. I already believe in God. That's it. That's my premise. Now, how can I get there? And then, you know, 2 hours later, they're still, you know, trying to talk you into it through these syllogisms. And, you know, to me, they just don't work. It's so much blah, blah, blah. And it just doesn't hold. But, you know, they'll make their case.
Word soup, indeed. And Michael, you should bring on Ken Ham as a guest one day on your show.
Oh boy, well that would be interesting. I might do that.
I think you should.
That would be in the category of people I wouldn't normally talk to see if I
bring them on.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
I might do that. That's a good idea. You've talked me into it.
I have been listening to your show for quite some time. Definitely feel like a Ken Ham would just really just put you over again.
All right. I'll do it. I'll
contact
him.
Perfect.
Although, you know, Bill Nye had his thing with Ken. They did that live debate, which was pretty interesting. We actually prepped Bill at my house. Actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Brought over Don Prothrose, a professional geologist who has debated creationists, and he laid out for Bill, you know, here's the 20 reasons why we know evolution happened. And Bill pretty much followed that formula, and I thought he did a good job. I know he was criticized in the scientific community for even debating Ham, and, you know, it's a debatable subject whether you should debate these people. I don't know. I mean, it's what I do. It's what Bill does. The thing is that, you know, of course we're not going to convert people who already believe that position. No, but that's not who we're after. We're after the undecided voters, the independent voters, so to speak, people that haven't made up their mind.
Yeah. And going back to social media and when I said you'd be on the program, are you familiar with a individual by the name of John E.L. Tenney?
Nope. Never heard of him.
Okay. Well, he was pretty quick on Twitter once I announced you'd be on.
Yeah.
I invited him to call in, but I don't think he wants to chat with us in a serious manner. He's, from what I recall, one of my listeners wanted me to interview him, and I thought, sure, why not? And apparently he's one of these lecturers who go around talking about their personal experience with, I guess you could say, the afterlife. He had this experience, this near-death experience, and he claims he was, I guess, given a choice whether to live or to go to the other side. I'm not quite sure how his story goes, but I thought you might be familiar with him since he was so quick to respond.
I never heard of him. I mean, there's a thousand of those near-death experience type stories
it's
out
pretty
there.
Common. Yeah, his experiences are extremely common from what I gathered.
Yeah, totally. So I don't know what, you know, most of it has to do with the power of personal experiences. That is, you know, it's really hard to convince somebody that's experienced something that they didn't experience what they think they experienced. Which is why I always point to people that have similar experiences who have recognized that they're not otherworldly or supernatural. You know, like, Oliver Sacks's books are all about these kinds of weird things that people experience that, in fact, we know exactly what it is, what's causing the, you know, the hallucination or whatever. It's this brain chemistry, a tumor, a stroke, you know, whatever, just these weird disorders people have. And, you know, from there, I try to convince them that at least plant a seed of a reasonable doubt. You know, do you think it's possible that, you might have had one of these brain experiences and that's what, accounts for your personal experience?
Right. Well, yes, and you definitely have the proverbial target on your back in terms of being that guy to convince for validation to X, Y, and Z claim.
Yep. Well, that's what I do. So it's okay.
it's perfectly fine. That's what you've been doing for such a long time. And I would imagine you get plenty of emails of individuals just like him that want to give you their two cents.
Yes, and that's good. I mean, I like to hear from people. It's okay.
Sure.
I mean, I respond to emails if people want to write me their stories. Try to keep them short. you know, but the problem with personal testimonies is that they are, by definition, non-falsifiable. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know who you are. I don't know what was going on in your life at the time this experience happened. And, you know, maybe you had a bad pork chop. Maybe you had magic mushrooms. Maybe you were you were hungover, you know, maybe you were bereaved, severe depression because of a loss. I don't know. Those are all the kinds of things that happen to people, you know, that, in part account for these experiences. And so we have to look at the whole thing.
Certainly. And I've talked to a few people who have mentioned seeing, people in the clouds and in rocks. And of course, things like that can be logically explained. And in this case, that would be due to anthropomorphism.
Yeah, I call it patternicity, the tendency to find meaningful patterns in both meaningful and meaningless noise. And then we infuse it with agency. So I call that agenticity, the tendency to infuse patterns with intentional agents. We all do it. it's hard to overcome it. But it explains a lot in terms of beliefs in ghosts and gods and aliens and angels and conspiracies and so forth.
Right. And I believe someone in the chat room wanted me to ask you about your thoughts and opinions on UFOs.
Oh, right.
Go ahead.
UFOs. So that's, well, there's two questions here, really. Are aliens out there somewhere in the cosmos, and have they come here? Those are two different questions. Now, most scientists will say, well, we don't know either way, for both those questions. But very likely there's intelligent life somewhere in the cosmos just by the sheer number of possibilities. No matter how low the probability is because of all the factors that have to come together, the fact that there's trillions and trillions of planets in every galaxy, it now appears. It appears every star has planets and maybe a dozen or so. And so by chance, with that huge number to start with, no matter how low the probabilities for any one of the factors that has to come together to get life and intelligence, it's going to happen. So they're probably out there somewhere. I think it's a big cosmos, a lot of empty space. I think that's why we haven't made contact yet. But the other question, have they come here?
Right.
The evidence for that is very thin.
Very thin. And Michael, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I do have a call and I think it's for you.
Okay.
Yeah,
let's
bring in. Caller, are you alive?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. This is, Kaiser.
Kaiser.
Calling in to say hey.
What's
I love it when you and Michael, when Michael and Michael, the M&M show, I love this show. And, you are two of my favorite, commenters.
Amazing.
So, just calling in. Yep. Just calling in. I think, Michael, I agree on a lot of the stuff he says. A lot of his intel he gets, well, you know what I do for a living, Mike, not Michael Shermer. I'm talking about you, Michael.
Yes.
You know what I do for a living. And, there's a lot that you do see and some of it's unreal. In my trade, just to be clear with him, why don't you tell him, Michael, so that I don't have to. I don't want to toot my own horn, brother.
Oh, well, this was a DOD member here.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
A very prestigious one at that.
And what did you, what subjects were you investigating?
Oh, it wasn't what I was investigating. It was what was I was involved in. I've worked for DOD since I was 17. First started out in the Army as a military policeman, then in the Marine Corps as a military policeman, 5811, 95 Bravo in the Army when there was still a Berlin Wall, Adak, Alaska, which actually had Classic Wizard, which was the forerunner to HAARP.
Right.
I guarded that. And then bounced into Federal Service after that with my first agency that I never named. After I was a union iron worker putting myself through college, and 2001 happened, and October 26th, I was on the ground in Afghanistan, left there in the beginning of 2003, went to work for DLA, Defense Logistics Agency, as an investigator, and then went on to contract in 05, and for a brief stint, I worked for Homeland with Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Detroit, Philadelphia.
Yeah, he's done a lot.
So what's the, what are some of the most unusual things you've had happen to you or seen?
Well, one of them's totally unbelievable and I don't talk about it anymore because a brother of mine blew his brains out after I did. I did actually out something that was pretty major. So I will not talk about it again. Michael knows this. He knows the story. He can tell you offline. Like, you know, you witness some things. Like I saw a ghost one time. In a warehouse, that was real. I mean, that was a real deal thing. I've, been there for the unearthing of mass graves in Iraq from the Shias. I worked in, Al-Kut, province and Camp Delta was where we were based out of. I've worked around ODA, bunch of different stuff, you know, it just is what it is. And, I'm still a contractor to this day. I've worked for the Chinese, I've worked for the Afghans themselves, but always in U.S. interest. And even worked here in the U.S. Michael knows about that. If he wants to talk about it, he can tell you. I make the news. I get just Forrest Gump myself through the world.
That's pretty amazing, really.
I was in Charlottesville for the whole setup and saw what happened.
Right.
And if you ever want to look up David Duke in Charlottesville, you'll see me, and I was not bodyguarding that piece of shit. Excuse me, I didn't mean to say that on the program.
That's okay.
But I was bodyguarding a podcaster who was trying, David Duke was trying to make himself relevant by being close to him. And I got a visit by the FBI, the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
You did? Because of it.
Wow. That's pretty scary.
Yeah. No, I was a former Fed. They had a 3/8-inch file on me.
Well, I mean, for
and
someone...
they didn't know the pertinent...
Right, but I mean, in terms of someone like myself, if I got that sort of visit, I'd be freaked out. I'm sure Michael would be freaked out, too.
Yeah,
no, they have
totally.
To follow up. They couldn't parallel construct on me because they had facial rec up. They had voice rec. They also had the Mavericks and also the, what was that called? It's all cell phone collection data. And Dukes. They had that stuff up, and they knew who I was. But a buddy of mine was going through a divorce. Me and my wife and my son helped fund his divorce because he was on disability. And his wife decided to call in and report me. You know, she made a big deal out of it. Like, oh, he's next to David Duke. Yeah, okay. Yeah, no. I don't give a shit about David Duke.
Right.
And I just said it again. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
Mike.
But all good.
Anyways, you know, you just find yourself in history. And that's honestly what should happen. What's your thoughts on that, Michael? Because honestly, listening to you, it seems like you're a fellow, not a fellow traveler as a communist, but you're a traveler
right. Also.
You're somebody that just exists and finds himself in cool places.
Well, that's right. So when I meet people like you, I'm very open to hearing your experiences because I know when you're working in government agencies like that, there's a lot of stuff you see that we civilians don't know about, which is what Michael and I were talking about earlier with revelations like with the Pentagon Papers and the WikiLeaks papers that, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on that, you know, that I'm guessing most congressmen didn't know about. And, so that's a kind of a conspiracy, that goes on and that we should be alert to. And that, to that extent, I'm glad there are whistleblowers and laws to protect whistleblowers because how else would we know about those things? So that's good to know. On the other hand, I do recognize there has to be national secrets. We can't, you know, have free speech in which we share the nuclear codes with the Russians, obviously. So there's restrictions there. But in general, I always like hearing stories from people like you that worked on the inside. You know, now that said, the WikiLeaks, both Pentagon Papers and WikiLeaks, showed the absence of something. There was an absence of, for example, any evidence for UFOs, what we were talking about earlier.
Yes.
There were no memos about, you know, the alien bodies in Roswell or, and for that matter, 9/11 is an inside job. There was, you know, in the WikiLeaks, you know, millions of documents, not one having anything to do with, you know, Bush administration knowing about 9/11 ahead of time and, or any of that stuff.
The only two real issues I have with 9/11, and I'm Michael, end of days, just going to put it that way so we can not keep saying Michael, and you guys maybe don't know who I'm talking about. I'll ask this final question and make a statement. And two issues I had with 9/11. Well, there's three, actually. But on the 10th, two things happened. First thing, a lot of people mind dump on. And it was when you had the Secretary of Defense get up and say, we've lost X amount. I think it was like $4 trillion, $3.7 trillion, if I remember right. And I could be faulty on that, so please fact check. And when Rumsfeld said that, that was fine. And then also there was the assassination of Amir Massoud in Afghanistan. The Lion of the Pangaea. If people don't know who it is, look it up. You'll find out. Then September 11th happened. The two buildings I really don't have an issue with. What I have an issue with is two things on that day. First off, Building 7. Look who collected the insurance money on it. The second thing I have an issue with is the missile. Notice I'm not saying an aircraft. The missile impacted on DFAS, Defense Finance Accounting Center's area, okay? That are the two things I have an issue with. Everything else I can buy, but those two things I have an issue with. for 9/11. So notice I said 9/10 and 9/11. Notice I'm not disputing you, or and I'm definitely not counteracting you, Mr. Shermer.
That's okay.
I'm not counter-signaling you.
Yeah, counter-signaling. Yeah, that's all good. Yeah, I'm aware of all those arguments, and I can't go through them all now. In fact, I have to sign off here, Michael, because I got to go down and teach my class.
I know, we got to wrap it up pretty here.
But in short, if you go to skeptic.com and you type in 9/11, we have a bunch of articles on there that address all these issues, you know, Building 7 and the Pentagon, and was it a missile or a plane, and so on. You know, we do address that.
No doubt.
Well, like I said, I'm looking forward to me and Mr. Deacon are going to be on Jaffe Riders WPRPN, World Pirate Radio Podcast Network, and we'll go through this stuff too. But like I said, I try to out everything I can. Hopefully Michael Deacon can fill you in offline. I'm going to hang up. You gentlemen,
thanks for the call.
I love listening more than talking. God bless.
Thank you. Take care. All right. Bye-bye. And there he goes. And Michael, I do want to thank you for being a part of the program yet again and spending some time with us here. And of course, your latest book is Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality and Utopia, rather.
That's it. You got it right.
I actually didn't have that written down anywhere. I just went off the top of my head. So I wasn't sure if I said any of those things correctly.
Your memory is still working.
Amazing.
Well, thanks for having me on, and thanks for taking that call. I do always find those people interesting.
Yeah, very.
That have worked in government agencies.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's all good. So,
and of
thanks.
Course, check out Science Salon, your podcast. Great stuff, Michael. We'll do this again in the near future, my friend.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye bye.
All right, bye bye.
And there he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That was Dr. Michael Shermer. I would like to thank all of you out there in the chat room, and of course, those at Deprogrammed Radio and coming right up. And I also can't forget those at Steampunk Radio. What a lovely bunch all of you are out there. And if you enjoyed the program, please help spread the word. Tell a friend. Go to michaeldeacon.com. If you want to donate, hit that PayPal button there. And of course, if you heard this on YouTube, make sure to subscribe to the channel and leave a comment. If you liked tonight's program, once again, I'll see you on Saturday, 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Michael Deacon, and with that said, the world is a mysterious place, and life itself is a mystery. Until next time, good night, everybody.